Hey, listeners, and hope you're doing well. Hope you're healthy. Hope you're enjoying the world incrementally opening up again. And welcome to this week's podcast. Unfortunately, we're here today because one of our former guests, BJ Thomas, has passed away. And I thought we should revisit our chat. This was recorded in January 2010. He just passed away a few days ago, age 78, of lung cancer. He was diagnosed and just a few weeks later passed away. Amazing career, though, and that's what we'll celebrate today. He had 14 top 40 hits, and I think it's worth noting that, to me, the top 40 era, the era of time when the top 40 radio format was so dominant in the United States of America, where it so influenced the charts, and what's amazing about it is the democratic nature of it, how there were just a few radio stations in every city that blasted these songs over and over again, and it seemed like there was a little more agreement as to, you know, young, old, you know, different races, different geographies in the United States of America all listening to the same music. And yes, I guess the music had to be slightly more poppy and less edgy to appeal to such wide audiences, but nevertheless, to make 14 top 40 hits during that era, to me, is being part of something that was unique and awesome. Some of those hits were Hooked on a Feeling, number 5 in 1968. Of course, the band Blue Suede would cover Jonathan King's version, and they would take it to number 1. Lots of folks have covered it. It's such a great song. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head was number 1 in 1969 from the soundtrack of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Apparently, Bob Dylan and Ray Stevens were both offered the chance to sing that song in the movie and turned it down. Number 1 for him, and Academy Award winner for Best Song. And then Hey Won't You Play Another Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song in 1975 also went to number 1. So amazing career for BJ Thomas. Let's remember him and enjoy this chat. It's me and BJ Thomas back in 2010. Yeah, there's the great B.J. Thomas, the eyes of a New York woman, and joining us on the phone. B.J. Thomas, welcome to WFMU. Good morning.
Ah, thank you. Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
I know you're on the West Coast. It's a little bit early, and I appreciate a guy like you waking up for us. I haven't had your coffee yet, I understand.
Yeah, no. Hey, well, I'll get it. I'll get it soon, hopefully.
You know, that's one of my favorite songs we heard of yours right there, but in the course of doing this interview, I listened to, you know, everything, and we just heard about a half hour of B.J. Thomas music, and I really fell in love with some of the real, real early stuff. You know, you had so many big hits that I think some people don't really know about that very, very early period for you.
Yeah, the early things off of, you know, the I'm So Lonesome, I Could Cry, and the Tomorrow Never Comes Out, they're rather primitive, and I was still kind of, you know, basically finding my, you know, exactly finding my style or finding my legs as far as recording.
Well, that's interesting.
When I think that, you know, New York Woman, when I got to Memphis, I really was more or less into what I was going to do then. I was with a great band and a great producer, and you know, I'd had I'm So Lonesome and Mama before, but I think I improved a great deal when I got to Memphis.
Well, that's interesting, because we heard Garner State Park, and we heard Going Through the Motions and Vietnam, a few of your real early cuts, and I thought that same thing. I thought, here's a guy who's listening to the top 40 and hasn't quite found his own thing.
That's what we got our playlist and what we were doing off the top 40 radio. So we did a little bit of everything that was on that chart.
Well, let's talk about the very early days. You're born in Oklahoma, but you're really a Texas guy, grew up in Texas, and I guess you probably started singing in church, right?
Yeah, I started singing in little churches that we just happened to, just by chance, live by. And so we you know, we kind of got involved in that, and always loved, you know, of course, that was back in a in the time when we had Ricky Nelson, Elvis Presley, and I always loved those two guys and loved their music. And,
yeah, you're born in 1942, which makes you just the perfect age. You know, you're 12 years old or something when Elvis comes on the radio for the first time, or 12 or 13 when Bill Haley, those guys burst on the scene. It's all over for you, I assume. There's no...
Yeah, I just love those guys. Of course, when I first heard Elvis Presley, and you know, Ricky was on television every week, And I guess my biggest heroes were all the black singers of my time. I mean, they were the best singers of that time. I don't think that's exactly so now, but they were the guys that we kind of looked up to. And of course, that was in that time of Little Richard and Chuck Berry and Hank Ballard and all those guys, Jackie Wilson and Ray Charles and all those guys that really kind of set the high water mark of how to do it.
Yeah, you joined a band called The Triumphs, I think, while you're still in high school. And how many pieces were in that band? How big a band was it?
I think counting me, it was an 8-piece band. We had a 3 or 4-piece horn section, and so we could duplicate a lot of different kind of music. We had a great guitar player, Tim Griffith, and we had a good band. We were very competitive. We were there was another great band in that area. A guy named Roy Head had a band called The Traits, and Roy Head ended up having Treat Her Right and a bunch of things later on.
We've had Roy on the program. He's a complete maniac. Was he a maniac when he was?
He kind of was. Yeah, I mean, when he was 17, 18, 19 years old, if he could have gotten a break then, he would have been one of the biggest of all time, because he was a very exciting stage performer. And we had a lot of, back in those days, they called them battle dances, and we had a lot of battle dances with those guys. And our bands drew the biggest crowds in that area, and they were really great. And a great guy, too. I still talk to him all the time.
So it would be The Traits versus The Triumphs, kind of?
That's
fun. And so those kind of gigs, you're playing for teenagers, or you're playing for just white kids?
Yeah,
there?
We're playing for kids, and... probably in the most case. Roy played a lot of city gigs in the San Antonio and Houston, Austin, places like that. We were a little bit too young to be in the nightclubs in the city, so we played mostly the big dance halls out in the boondocks, and so most of our crowd was white for a long time, until I had my first hit and got out with Dick Clark and started playing across in a national sense. I mostly played, for just a bunch of country kids.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there is, throughout your career, there's still a little bit of that Texas swamp in everything. It's interesting how, your very early 60s kind of hits and non-hits and the Texas thing, it all sort of comes together later. Every bit of your varied influence is in there. I mean, what was the scene like? It was, the very early 60s and all these kids dancing and stuff. Was it something, was it like an education for you?
Oh, absolutely. It was just like going to school, I was just learning how to do it. And when I was very lucky, too. I wasn't, having to try to be a singer and a recording artist who didn't have a band. So I had a band where I was kind of learning how to sing and how to perform a little bit. And we would play these big dance halls, and there'd be, 2,000 kids would come out of those little country towns and come to see us. Mm. And they were basically dancing. They just weren't standing there watching the band. But we would play and play, and as the years, the time went by, it got to where basically half the crowd was standing there looking at us because we were really getting it done.
That sounds like so much fun. I wish.
Yeah, it was. It was just. It was just the best,
So tell me, you mentioned Dick Clark tour. I know that you toured with Dick Clark with guys like James Brown and Gene Pitney and, some big, big stars. Was that one of the things where you played 5 shows a day and played a 20-minute set, or how'd that work?
Well, when they first booked me out, they booked me out with James Brown, then I did a show with Jackie Wilson and Johnny Mathis, and they thought I was a black guy off of I'm So Lonesome, and they realized that, no, he's not an R&B singer, so they booked me with Dick Clark, and I would sing my hit records, and it was a part of I was with a tour of about 15 different acts, and everybody would get on stage and just do their hits, and a guy like Gene Pitney would headline. And it was a great time, because you could see a lot of great people and see them do their hit records as as their songs were currently hit records. My band backed up the show. I was the guy with the band, so when I was booked, the Triumphs, so-called, backed the entire show, and I had to put together a new band because the original Triumphs didn't want to go. And so I put together another band, and I went out, and that's how the whole thing got started. I've just been doing it ever since.
That's amazing. I mean, you always hear about that time everybody's in the bus together, and it sounds like, you know, something that you just couldn't recreate today. There's just no
that's
way.
That's how we did it. Yeah, the bands, they wouldn't do it nowadays because they have to have their own sound man and their own setup, and this was one setup, my band set up, and the band, the different entertainers would just bang, 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 come on one after another. And, I guess it's something you can't do again because people are particular about the way their sound, but this was people weren't doing each act wasn't doing a show, it was just doing their hits. Some people had one hit, some people had two. I happened to have three at that time, so I did my three songs and get off, and it was great.
That's incredible. And how much money did you guys get paid for something like that? Was it?
Oh yeah, you know, I think that first tour was 94 shows in 100 days. And Dick was very good at that. He'd play some big high school in Philadelphia, and then he'd do Madison Square Garden the next day. So he knew how to make money and book the shows. And I think I was paid $2,200 a week that first tour.
That's not bad at all.
Was a lot of money.
Yeah. Back then, that's not bad really. And also, finally, you make it out of Houston. I mean, were you at what point in your life did you know? You know, in the sort of the Triumphs history, did you know, okay, I'm going to be a musician, that's it, you know? When did you know that?
Well, I was a little bit in denial with that, although, you know, I was in the band, and, I really wanted to have a hit record, but of course I knew I was never going to have one. I mean, how was I going to have a hit record? but I love the music, and so that's just all I wanted to do, and then... kind of out of nowhere, I cut this Hank Williams thing for my dad, and somehow it found its way out and was a big hit record. It was a number one record in Houston, and the next thing I know, bang, I was out on stage with Dick Clark, and they announced me. I come out, there's 10,000 people there, and I think to myself, you know, what have I gotten myself into? But I never expected that. You know, it wasn't until I actually got on that tour and was up in front of a lot of big crowds before I realized, okay, this is what you've always wanted. Now you have to learn how to do it.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Yeah, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. The Triumphs had a bunch of singles. None of them were huge hits, but I guess all of it is sort of a progression towards something. And
yeah, it was. You know, none of the singles really. You know, this was at a time when the local radio would play your music. You know, even if it wasn't very good, they'd play it for a couple of weeks. And the first song we cut that really stood up and sounded like a hit record was I'm So Lonesome. And, bang, it was a hit in 3 weeks. And, I did a couple of tours, as we said, a few nights with James Brown and Jackie Wilson. And then I was out with Dick Clark. And so it was a pretty quick turnover.
Yeah. You get signed. I guess that master gets leased. It gets released a few different times. You end up on Scepter Records, which was a very interesting label. I think it was, it wasn't in a big city. You know, it wasn't in an L.A. or New York label.
Scepter Records was the national label that picked up Lonesome. And they were on West 58th Street in New York City.
Oh, they were.
They were a very important independent label. I mean, they had Twist and Shout, Louie, which were huge records and very important records for their time. And they had Dionne Warwick and they were Chuck Jackson and these people. They were a very important independent label, and they were in New York City. When I signed with them, I moved to New York for a while, and that was another great education.
Yeah, that must have been mind blowing for a guy from Texas, for a teenager.
Well, it really was. I loved it. When I left Houston, I went to Memphis, and that's where I really started making some good records. And when I got the shot to do Raindrops, do the Butch Cassidy film score, the song out of the score, then I moved to New York. And I concentrated on working with Bert and Hal David,
How interesting. You moved around so much. I mean, you moved labels a lot, and you also physically moved yourself quite often. It's kind of
amazing. I was with Scepter for, till...
I think 8 albums, which is...
I was with Scepter for 8 albums, so that was a pretty long stay.
Yeah, They had
some financial problems and went out of business, and I signed with ABC Records, and their first... They hadn't been in the record business before. Was that Gulf and Western? And they started a record label, and the first record they had was, "Hey, won't you play another Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song?" So that's not in these... in this collection, but we kept moving pretty good.
Not bad, yeah. Tell me about when you were working with Scepter, they had you work with Huey Moe, who was a Texas guy, another guy with an incredible reputation. His name's on a lot of amazing records, a real wheeler dealer, a real crazy guy, wound up in jail. What was he like to work with?
Well, I really didn't do anything with Huey. I made a lot of records, and then his... he would sign everyone, and so I ended up, the guy I was making records with knew that I needed to be with somebody that could get me airplay a little better and somebody who would do me some good. So he gave my contract to Huey or sold it to him, but I never really had much to do with him. I produced those first records myself, just with my band, and he wasn't even in the studio
I
recorded.
That's interesting.
I know he had his name on it, and then it took us a couple of years to get away from him. I got away from him before I went to Memphis.
That's
thank
interesting.
God.
Yeah, okay. That clears that story.
He was one of those guys, a lot of guys like that across that country, who just signed everybody, and when you made it, well, then you had him to carry.
Yeah, you had a lot of guys who wanted to piece you at a certain point, and finally, like you said, you got to Memphis. And you started working with Chips Moman and the American Studios guys, and luckily you found a bunch of songs by Mark James.
Yeah, Mark called me and said, "Hey, what are you doing?" I said, "Nothing. I'm not doing anything right now." He said, "Man, I wish you'd come up to Memphis. I'm writing a lot of songs," and he said they're cutting a lot of hit records here. And for a couple of years, Memphis had around 20% of the pop chart, which was a great accomplishment back in the time of Motown and Stax and all that. So they were making a lot of hit records, and so I moved up. And when I the first time I got in and sang with them, just kind of a little demo thing, we just went together perfectly. I mean, they were like my band, and I was like their singer. So we just about everything we cut worked really good and sounded good, and that's. That's when I made The Eyes of a New York Woman, and followed that with Hooked on a Feeling. And
1968. Tell me about Chips Moman. He's another guy who kind of a legendary guy. He doesn't do any interviews. He's some people hate him, some people love him. What was that whole working situation like?
Well, he was always a kind of a tough guy to work with, but he was a wonderful guy with the music. He knew what a hit record was, and he knew how to put it together, and he knew how to, and he had this great band, the American Studio Group were a great band, just like Motown had the great band, and Stax had the great band.
And Muscle Shoals, it's right in that.
And he did too, and I mean, he was doing some wonderful work with this great band, but he was a great, great producer, he was a great guy, he's always been like been like my brother, but of course we're not speaking to each other right now. But I love him to death,
like a brother.
Yeah.
So tell me, I mean, when you first heard "Hooked on a Feeling," a song like that, how did it come to you? Is there a demo, or did Mark James sit down and just play it for you?
Yeah, Mark sat down and played it for me, and Chips had brought down, I think, at some time during the days we were recording that session, he brought an electric sitar down, and he got to Reggie to use it a little bit on The Eyes of a New York Woman. And when we did Hooked on a Feeling, he wanted Reggie to really, really stretch it out and play it extensively on that song. And so he did. And that was kind of the signature of that great electric sitar ride that he did in the on the front, in the middle, and the back.
Yeah, it's 1968, and it kind of works perfectly there. It's not too much or too little, and that song has become, it's sort of one of those oldies that's bigger than it was at the time. I'm surprised that wasn't a number one hit, because it's so heavy in oldies rotation now, and it gets used in movies and things so often that you would think, but some songs become bigger, that that has longer legs than other songs.
Well, I think, I was always caught in a situation where I never really had the real good management. Scepter was a great label for its time, but they weren't CBS or Warner Brothers. Maybe different circumstances would have produced maybe some bigger things. Yeah. We sold a lot of records, but I'm with you. I think the support I had record label wise and management wise was a little less than I should have had.
Yeah, the records are better than the support was.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, tell me, when you're cutting at American Studios, are you singing live with the band?
Yeah, I'm singing live. I'm doing very little re-singing. When we get the take that sounds good, that's the take we take, and it just was a great way to record. It was so much fun. We'd take a song and we wouldn't figure it out. Nobody would write all the parts for it. We kind of learn it on the spot, and begin to do it and let it come together as we learned it. And sometimes that would produce a really great feeling, feeling kind of song.
Yeah, just kind of work the song up.
Yeah, absolutely.
You cut Suspicious Minds, and your version sounds like it was recorded the day before or the day after Elvis's version. You know, it's the same band, the same studio.
Same band, yeah.
Almost the same arrangement. It's a great record. Did you cross paths with Elvis back then?
Oh, yeah, I did. We would see each other. A lot of people just would hang around him all the time. I wasn't really inclined to just go to his house and just hang there, but he did like me, and I might have had something to do with a record I had called Mama, and of course his love for his mother was legendary, as we all of course love our mothers. But he'd have a Valentine party or a Christmas party, and he'd ask me to sing, and I'd go do my stuff for him, and I had a great admiration for him. He always treated me like a buddy, and I still miss that guy.
Yeah, what fun. It's an amazing life you've had. We're talking to BJ Thomas here. So the next step, from big hits here, Hooked on a Feeling and New York Woman and working with Chips Holman, you wind up singing Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, like you said, produced by Burt Bacharach and Hal David in that movie, and it wins a Grammy, and it becomes a huge number one song.
Yeah, they won an Academy Award for it. Burt was a mainstay. Of course, he produced, and Burt and Hal produced and wrote all the Dionne Warwick stuff. And so almost from the get-go, there was a guy, a friend of mine, that worked for Scepter as a promotion man, and a guy named Steve Tyrell, and a guy named Paul Cantor. And these guys were working from the get-go to try to get Bacharach to do a session on me. And when the Raindrops Keep Falling song came along, it obviously wasn't a Dionne Warwick song, and I kind of was in the right place there. I flew out to California and went to Burt's house and rehearsed the song, and we cut it for the soundtrack. Then about a month and a half later, we recut it for the single version, where he did the tag, that kind of signature little tag.
Yeah, with the extra two.
It was great working with him. I got a great respect for that guy. We didn't get along great at that time.
What does that mean? What, he just
well, you know, we kind of butted heads. I was kind of this, I was kind of a, how do you put that? I was kind of a rough kind of punk kind of guy, and he was this very sophisticated composer. And of course, he wanted me to learn how to read music, and I said, well, hey, I don't want to read music, and mess with my feel and stuff. So we kind of butted heads from the word go. But over the years, he learned to respect me, and he knew that I was doing his songs well, and I learned to respect him. I think he's got to be one of the top three composers of all time from our country, and maybe even in the world. But just one of the great pop songwriters of our time.
Yeah, you cut a few songs by him, and they're all real interesting. And it's such a comparison to what we just talked about, the Chips Moment, Work It Up in Your Head versus this Burt Bacharach.
Yeah, it was totally different there. Everything was written out, and even after a while, I moved from Memphis. I went down to Atlanta, down to Doraville, Georgia, and the studio group down there was the Atlanta Rhythm Section before they became a hit band, and I recorded with Buddy Bowie down there, and that's some of the best records I made too. Most of all, Mighty Clouds of Joy and No Love at All and some of those things. So I'm really proud of those too. Yeah.
Tell me, I mean, this whole time you've got now number one records. It's huge. How did you deal with fame? Did you deal with it well or not?
No, I didn't deal with it very well because, you know, I had some isms going on. I had some addictions going, and, you know, I just... I kind of burned the candle at both ends back in those days, and so I had some hard time. You know, when I recorded, I always made sure that I was sober and that I was at my best. But otherwise, when I traveled and when I performed, sometimes I was not in the best shape I could be in. And you know, I'm the first guy to make. To make videos. I made the first video that had a script to it that wasn't just a performance video. We made these videos for the television shows back then so that they would have something that was really good. And, you know, of course, there was no market for it back then. They wanted you live or they didn't want you. But I didn't handle it very well. It was a tough thing. It took me a long time to get my feet on the ground and be able to do it without... I don't know, without maybe a little self-doubt and some anxiety about it, but, you know, those things are gone now.
Was there any mentors? Was there anybody who came to you and said, hey, BJ, you got to, you know, get together or you're just not going to last? Or what happened? I mean, I always wonder how...
Well, as we look back, it's funny how that comes up a lot, but as we look back, you know, I had to get through my thing, and I never really had anybody who was faithful to me who would do my music. You know, the first kind of ego thing that would come up between the record company or Chips or, you know, egos played a big role, and these guys, their egos would get in the way of the music, and so that's why I did move around a lot because, you know, these guys, you know, the Tyrell and Chips, they would have these big ego clashes, and so I'd have to go somewhere else to record. So I never really had the guy who was... just real faithful to me that was going to help me do my music from for all time, and a guy who was going to watch my money for me, and you know, I never really had those guys. It would have been a little different if I'd had somebody who was there kind of committed to take care of me. And so I had to kind of mentor myself, and you know, I took the long way home. I had to learn the hard way. I'm one of those guys who I had to dig it out of the dirt for myself, you know.
That's interesting. Scepter Records went out of business. You moved to Paramount for a little while, then to ABC, and you had another giant hit with Hey, Won't You Play Another Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song.
Yeah.
How'd you find that song?
Well, I had just recorded an album called Billy Joe Thomas, and we had Rock and Roll Lullaby for that. Yeah. And for some reason, you know, all of a sudden the company goes out of business. So I did. They wanted me to go with Dunhill, ABC Dunhill, and so you know I did. And the first session I did was Chips and the American Studio Group had moved to Nashville, and they had a studio there. And so I flew down and I did a session with them, and that's when we cut Wrong Song. And I just always did. I tell you, Chips. And that band, they were also always so great. I really think those guys deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, as many
sure.
hits as they were on. But that's where I did that one in Nashville.
It's kind of striking to me the difference between the, you know, the sound of that just a few years later and the sound of your earlier American stuff. You know, it's definitely the mid-70s all of a sudden.
Well, they started they started kind of they toned it down a little bit, and they kind of always would put a touch of raindrops Wrong Song, maybe you don't notice it right at first, but it has a touch of raindrops in it, and so the people always had that feel afterwards and tried to put that feel in there every now and then, and I think that's what Chips was trying to do with Wrong Song.
It's a great AM radio, you know, hit song there. I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here to BJ Thomas. It's Michael Shelley, and you're tuned here to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. You know, I want to backtrack for one second. I forgot to ask you about, I think it's your song Billy and Sue, cut in Nashville with the Nashville cream of the crop, Grady Martin, Bob Moore, Ray Stevens, Buddy Harmon. What was that like?
Man, that was the thing. I went into Nashville in 64. This was even before Lonesome. They wanted to record me, and I went and recorded, and it actually came out on Warner Brothers Records. And you know, it was during the Tearjerker era, Last Kiss, and those things. And
right.
And a friend of mine named Mark Sharon wrote those kind of songs really well. And anyway, we cut Billy and Sue, and it came when it came out, it was not a hit record. But then after I had Lonesome and Mama, a guy named Wesley Rose, who had a who was the son of the legendary publisher in Nashville, he bought that master and put it out, and then it was a hit record in 66 along with the others. So,
and did you know how big those, you know, how powerful those musicians were at the time? You were such a young...
Yeah, I did. I knew I was with the A-Team in Nashville, and, of course, I was in awe of all those guys because I'd heard of them, you know, through Hank Williams and people that, I'd always loved on music. And so, yeah, I knew they were the big-time recording guys, and I was thrilled to be with them.
Yeah. So, hey, why don't you play another Somebody Done Somebody Wrong song? Started you down the country road, which you stayed on for an incredibly long time. I mean, in the 80s, 83, 84, you had number one hits like crazy. I mean, an incredible amount of number one hits.
Yeah, I had some
hits.
Good... I recorded with Pete Drake back then. I had some good things in the 80s. But you know what? Kind of what happened after Wrong Song... I quit the business for a period of time, I did have a personal turnaround, and which kind of led me into gospel music. And so in 77 I came out with a thing called Home Where I Belong, and I actually had the first four platinum albums in gospel music history. So I'm really proud of the achievements and the things I did in gospel.
And you also wrote
after I did those records, I kind of realized, you know, hey, I'm not in the I don't want to be in the gospel business, and so I kind of went. I went to Nashville. I was very good friends with Pete Drake, who was a legendary steel guitar player and country music producer, and we started doing things like Old Fashioned Love and Two Car Garage and New Looks from an Old Lover and Two Car Garage and you know, we had number one records on those things.
Yeah.
And a lot of fun.
Kind of a weird time for country music before country got sort of reinvented to this giant. It's a different animal now. Kind of record companies.
Yeah, I think you know, country music now is kind of doing the best they can to take the place of what we used to call pop radio. I mean, you really just don't have a lot of pop programming anymore unless you're on a you know, an oldie station. I mean, I have no idea whether they would even play Hooked on a Feeling nowadays. I guess it'd have to be country, you know.
Well,
but
it's interesting that it's one of the last sort of song-oriented, you know, genres. It's still, the songwriter is still revered in Nashville. You know, it's nothing without the song.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Man. That's so true. It's always kind of been that way, you know, it always starts with the song, and then you might, you know, you might blow it. You might not do the song like it should be done, but it always starts with a great songwriter.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way it's always been.
You also wrote a book called Home Where I Belong, where you're pretty honest about all of these this whole journey that you've taken, and folks can check
well,
that out.
Well, we tried to, you know, we had a huge gospel label down in Texas, pretty close to where we lived, and they wanted to do a book, and so we kind of did one. We think maybe one day we'll do another book and really tell the whole truth. But this was more of a you know, kind of with the in quotes a Christian book. You know, I mean, I can't really say that I've never been a religious person, so I've never been able to live that way. So that, but. The spiritual thing really is what turned me around and put me on the good road. But as far as being just a gospel singer or some kind of religious singer, that's not what I want to do.
Yeah.
But I think we all have to, you know, we have to dig out our lives for ourselves. We have to find what we're kind of all in school here learning with our lives what the important things are, and I think of course the spiritual element of my life was kind of the last thing I needed to get a hold of before I could be a real and a whole person.
Hey, did you have kids along the way?
Yeah, man, I've got three beautiful daughters who are grown. I've got three grandkids. I've been married to the same beautiful girl. Gloria and I've been married for 41 years, and. You know, if I'd never had a hit record, I still had a great life because of the family that I have.
That's amazing. You recorded the song to Growing Pains in the 80s. That was kind of a big hit and a song that's played every 5 minutes. And then in the 90s, there were some rumors that you died.
Yeah, I know.
Did that reach you?
There was a lot of rumors that I died in the that I passed away in the 90s for what I guess it was supposed to be a drug overdose. I don't know exactly how that happened, and maybe that would have been a good career move, but no, I'm still here.
still alive. You know, you've won, I think you've had, I wrote it down here, 15 top 40 songs sold over 70 million records. That's a lot of records. It's incredible. And just recently, all 8 of the Scepter records have been reissued on 2-for CDs with lots of bonus tracks and extras and stuff. So they all have like 26 songs or something on that.
Yeah, they've all got a huge amount of songs and outtakes on them. I think people who have been fans of mine, or even people who weren't fans, they'll really enjoy this collection. It's everything I did with Scepter Records, and I've been really enjoying hearing them myself. Of course, I still do. I have a record out now that we're hoping that, but there's a big corporation that may take it, and so I can't really say much about it. But it's a collection of Brazilian classics.
Yeah, you're huge.
I go down to Brazil quite often, and I've had a lot of hit records down there. So we did a lot of Jobim and Brazilian classic songs, and so we're working on that. And we're always trying to do something new. You know?
Yeah, and I see you're a busy guy. You're constantly touring. You're at a venue right now.
Yeah, I'm at a casino right now in Sacramento, California, and we did a show last night. And I'm headed back to Dallas in about an hour.
Wow. So on New Year's Eve, boy, you never stop working, you know?
Well, hey, you know, that's what I do, and, that's what I love to do, and I'm glad I still am able to do it. A lot of us guys from the old who still do the old school music, the people that love that music, they almost need to hear it worse now than they ever did. So it's been fun.
Yeah, well, you've been making records since the early 60s, and you're still making records, still out there playing. Folks can get some information. They can see your tour dates. They can buy some of these 2-for CDs and links and stuff there at bjthomas.com, right?
.com. Yeah, just come on there, and there's a bunch of things on there you might like.
Yeah, I've got the song Hooked on a Feeling queued up here. We're going to hear that now. I mean, you've sort of told us the story about it. What else do we need to hear, to know about this song, about this recording? Or just about how you feel when you're in the supermarket and this comes on. You know?
Well, I tell you, I loved singing the song. It was really kind of something that kind of nailed down a part of my style. It was written by Mark James. The band is just tremendous, and the guy that plays the electric sitar lead is a guy by the name of Reggie Young, and who is one of the greatest guitar players who ever lived. A lot of people who are great guitar players will tell you he's the best. So I was very fortunate to have made music with these guys. I'm very proud of this record.
Yeah, BJ Thomas, thanks so much.
Michael, thank you, pal. Appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Stays on my mind.
time tonight. Promise not to cry, and so will I when we say goodbye. There's trouble, something's wrong. They're sending me away to Vietnam to fight for my country in a war that shouldn't be, but is necessary. Russia, Red China, Vietnam, meet Uncle Sam. Ah, he's a mighty big man. He's gonna lend a helping hand. But if my buddy is bone sky, I bet I start wondering why I'm over there. Well, it's parting my hair when the world doesn't care. They don't care, they don't care, they don't care, they don't care, they don't care. Ah, so I'll be leaving you and leaving the things that we do. And then they call us young and reckless kids. Kids didn't start this war. So let me kiss that hole you died. Oh, what might be the last time tonight? Promise not to cry, and so will I when we say goodbye.
See people rushing round, being mean to one another, but even the worst of them will soon discover. Everybody needs to have a friend to sit and talk things over now and then. Someone to share some coke when they feel low. A glass of coke can make a friendship.